just after 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and that must mean it's time again for Money Management with Opus 111 Group's Mike Mayo. Here's Mike.
Good morning. Welcome to the latest installment of Money Management. We are your antidote to conventional wisdom. My name is Mike Mayo. We're all set for another hour of financial news, a recap on what's been going on in both the economy and the market world, as well as how it all can affect you. Now, this past couple weeks have been very unusual, I think is a good way to say it. You know, typically we don't get these, what they call doldrums in the market until, well, August, when people are all on vacation somewhere. Well, now they just flat don't know what to do, and so you're getting this, you know, what I call a dolphin market. It goes up a little bit, down a little bit, up a little bit, down a little bit, and that's all there is to it. It's a push-me-pull-you of the fact that the earnings have been, how would I say, doing pretty well, and the economy has held up, being a lot more resilient than a whole lot of folks had anticipated. So, let's look at where the indices closed yesterday. The Dow finished off 22 points at 33,808. The S&P closed at 4133. The Nasdaq traded last at 12,072. Russell 2000 at 1792. Gold settled at 1787 an ounce. Silver at 2495 an ounce. Crude closed at 7802 a barrel. 10-year Treasury at 3.56%. And soft white wheat at $7.58 a bushel. Now, that meant that week over week, just to tell you, like I was saying, the markets are doing basically nothing. The Dow was off 0.2 week over week. The S&P off 0.1. And the NASDAQ down a whole 0.4. So not really any way you can make any, how would I say, trend determinations from those kinds of data. And if you look back to the first of the year, we're up. Okay, I'm going to talk more about that in a while, but I'll just give you a couple of them. At the end of the year, the Dow was 33,147. Today, Friday it was 33,758. S&P at the end of the year, 38,39. S&P yesterday, 41,27. And the NASDAQ, you know, the big techs, all those guys, that was at 10,466 in December. It closed yesterday at 12,055. Now, you don't, that's not the general tenor of the news, is it? Well, let me give you a few headlines. We'll get, you know, a few things that I came across of what I think is of general interest, talk about some of these economic reports that came out, and also, of course, about the economy and some of the perspectives and perceptions that folks have that I think are, well, helping to lead to the fact that markets aren't doing anything. Now, here's, I think, a very important one. Wednesday or Thursday, the UN projected that India will surpass China sometime this year, if it already hasn't, in terms of population. So it will become the largest populated country in the world, like 1.4 billion in India to a mere 1.429 billion to a mere 1.426 billion. Now, us, well, we're at about 340 million, so kind of like, you know, over in a corner somewhere. But what it means is that's significant because they're rising, they meaning India, rising population. It's going to likely keep its economy growing, buy a whole lot more of the world's goods, and play a bigger role in global affairs, even as it, well, as it does, deals with its own internal issues. China's got big demographic headwinds, you know, lack of births and just all kinds of issues such as that, and it's going to make it harder for that country to achieve its own economic ambitions. Let me witness Japan, whose population has now fallen for 12 years in a row. You cannot grow if your population isn't growing. I mean, that's it. So, some real estate data that came out during the week. Residential construction fell slightly in March. Multi-unit construction was really the main reason for it, apartments and those kinds of things, condos. Meanwhile, single-family starts did rise for the second month in a row. That's for the first time in a couple of years. And the 30-year mortgage rates are, you know, running around 7% currently, and it makes a lot of these developer folks cautious about investing in projects, and I understand that. But it does look as if the single-family construction has at least found a temporary bottom. You know, and even though groundbreaking on new residential properties is down 17% year over year, please keep in mind that construction overall has hardly ground to a halt. There are a lot of projects already in the pipeline, and the number of homes under construction is actually near the highest level on record going back to 1970. This just gets in my craw, but you continuously, when you listen to the media, they will yab at you. They'll yab at you about data. Yeah, but this is this. Yeah, but that can go there. And they always default to the negative. And again, we get this market going nowhere because you have a lot of those kinds of thinking out there and folks just don't know what to do. So, you know, don't just listen to one source. Do your homework. And if nothing else, you know, just to use the term chill. For example, I was saying about these real estate developments, there's an ETF dedicated to home construction. And it's got a lot of the big builders in it. It hit a new 52-week high going all the way back to January 22. You didn't do that just with smoke and mirrors. Now, the National Association of Realtors, their chief economist, a gentleman named Lawrence Young, he had this to say, and I'm quoting, "Home sales are trying to recover and are highly sensitive to changes in mortgage rates. Yet, at the same time," he says, "multiple offers on starter homes are quite common, implying more supply is needed to fully satisfy demand." And this is a great quote. "It's a unique housing market." Amen. Yes, it certainly is. Now, he says the shock of higher financing costs on non-homeowners, meaning potential buyers, meant a short-term reduction in sales last year. But that negative effect could be diminishing as people do adapt to the higher level of rates. Now, while financing costs can remain a burden to many potential purchases, the good news for those prospective buyers is that the median prices have fallen on a year-over-year basis in March, down almost 13% from their peak in mid-22. So that's kind of fuel for the future in terms of purchases. Now, many homeowners they're going to be reluctant to add to the pool because they have what they call that mortgage lock-in phenomenon. Many folks bought or refinanced at way lower rates before last year, so that could limit future sales and inventories. But you know, you don't know that. While we do expect a moderation in national listing prices, the tight inventory of existing homes should prevent a repeat of 2008. There's just way more demand than there are houses, as opposed to the way it was in 08, which was the opposite of that. Case in point, what they call the month supply of homes, in other words, how long it would take to sell the existing home inventory at its even very slow current sales price, was 2.6 months. So the other way to say that is in 2.6 months, you would sell all the homes that are theoretically available for sale. The norm is around five months. It takes about 5 months. So again, way behind the curve in that regard. Oh, and by the way, speaking of real estate, this was not exactly over-promoted, but I think Wednesday, the Federal Housing Finance Agency has new fee changes that go into effect on the 1st of May this year. They're designed to push affordable housing by, ready for this, effectively subsidizing home buyers and refinancers with riskier credit ratings by charging higher fees to those with good scores. Seems to me that those changes are likely to cause a whole lot of confusion and result in higher monthly payments for most home buyers. So stay tuned, and I feel sorry for the real estate agents that have to explain that stuff. Excuse me. Another bit of business, you know, who pays the most tax? You may recall we did have a tax day here just recently. And this is broken out by the amount of income. It runs from 0 to 50,000, 50 to 100, 100 to 200, 2 to 5, 5 to a million, and a million and above. So the share of total income paid, less than 50,000 is minus 5%. In other words, subsidies and stuff, they're paying less than 5% of their income. The 50 to 100s pay around 5%. Now, who pays most of it? Real simple. 100 to 200 is around 20%. 200 to 500 pays about 25%. The 500 to a mil, they're, call it 18%. And the million above, about 40%. So I'm not exactly sure where all this stuff comes about, how tax the rich. It's, oh, they're not paying their fair share. That's totally political, folks, and you can do your own homework. This is from the Wall Street Journal, the analysis of the staff of the Joint Committee on Taxation. So you can look it up and check it out yourself. I am not making that stuff up. Now, in California, you all know California, 4.3% of their taxpayers, which is around 784,000 returns, pay a total of 68% of personal income tax. Oh, please, let me move there. It seems like these are the people you'd want to hold on to, yet every policy that comes out of Sacramento is the opposite. Yeah, well, there you are. Now, there's a report called the ALEC, that's capital ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, Laffer State Economic Outlook Rankings. They have been doing this for 14 years, and they weigh how the each state ranks in terms of 15 different economic policy virtues. Virtues isn't the word, is it? 50 variables. It's a V. Okay. Anyway, for the 14th straight year, Utah leading the pack. It makes sense, you know. Good tax policy, growth, educated workforce, et cetera, et cetera. Well, let me just read you the top five. That's Utah, North Carolina, Arizona, Idaho, and Oklahoma. Now, let's see. There's Washington is rated number 34, Montana number 33. So not exactly leading the league right now. So that's just give you some ideas to what the overall, how would I say, atmosphere for economic development in those particular states is. Now, a few words on inflation, because I think, again, other than politicians, this thing is still getting beaten up and brought out way too much of late. But let me give you, see, it's a lagging indicator, okay? See, the things that created the inflation or create inflation have already happened. You can change your behavior and change the attitudes going forward, for sure. Like, for example, all the money from the subsidies, the handouts, all that stuff that happened during when the bug was running around, well, that basically led to where we are now. But the Fed did, in fact, cut back on the money supply, the M2, as it's called. And so that the source of most of that excess growth is, a lot of it's been worked through the system. But see, that's, again, that happened before, but you're getting the result now. So you can't really legislate it away because, again, it's already happened. Let me give you some, for instances, about how some of these numbers have changed, well, for our point of view, to the better. You know, the global containers, the big 40-foot containers that are go on ships and rails and trucks, they were pretty expensive in February 2020. And they went way up about a year ago. 22, they were higher. But in any case, they're down to the point where they are lower than what they were before the bug showed up. That's the first drop since March of 2020. Now, on the other hand, one of the effects, the lagging effects of this inflation is new car prices. They are increasingly becoming unaffordable. Just go to the lots, check it out yourself. The average monthly payment for a new car is up to $777. That's nearly double, this is according to Kelley Blue Book, nearly double the average payment in late 2019. And 17% of the folks who financed the new car in the first quarter of this year have a monthly payment of $1,000 or more. That's a record high. up from just 6% of the people in the first quarter of 21, and that's from Edmunds. So what's driving this? Well, higher prices, higher financing rates. The average interest rate on a 48-month new car loan is up to about 7.5%. That's the highest since about 2007. Just a year ago, the rate was 4.87. So that spread from 4.87 to 7.46, that's the biggest difference since 1980 and 81. This is crazy. And so as a result, the kind of carry forward is the average age of passenger cars and trucks in the U.S. is gone up from 8.4 years in 1995 to a record currently of 12.3 years. So most cars are, the average car on the road is effectively 12 years old or more. And the other side, another point about inflation, oil prices have fallen to their lowest level in about 3 weeks. And that's due to a firmer dollar, which has the opposite effect on oil prices, and the rate hike expectations. And both of those benchmarks, that is both meaning West Texas Intermediate, which is U.S. crude, and the Brent crude, which is, if you will, the world crude, the North Sea, both of those have moved lower. So they have a big ripple effect, and with those prices being down, and they've been down, you're going to see, I think, an improvement in inflation rates going forward. Now, rolling over to the market, just some kind of bits and pieces, and I'm this is another of these, if you will, things that get in my craw about how the financial media at all promote data to, well, they don't necessarily put it out exactly as it's affected. Now, AT&T, big company, everybody knows AT&T, right? Well, the stock dropped 7% when they reported earnings this for their first quarter this past week. They missed, they earned $30.1 billion in 3 months. Not a bad few months' work. But the analysts, in their infinite wisdom, had said they should earn $30.2 billion. That's per Refinitiv, by the way. Now, and their earnings per share came in at about 60 cents, slightly above the 59 cents expected. So what happened? The stock got beat up to the tune of about a drop of 2 points. Now, to me, that's egregious. That's just, that's stupid. There's no reason that you should see a stock drop that much just because the stock didn't live up to what these analysts did. Why, who are these guys? You know, they're making guesses just like the rest of us. So these quarterly earnings that you see, please don't use them as the be-all, end-all for making an investment decision. What's the trend? What business is the company in? What's the future? I mean, yeah, it can be murky, but what do you gain by selling a perfectly good company, which is perhaps providing you a dividend and has typically provided good growth and is a good, has good management? You sell that, perhaps maybe even for a loss, and now what are you going to do with the money? Now, we'll talk about that in a minute, too. So, oh, by the way, there's this thing when it comes to bonds, well, more correctly, fixed income investments, meaning anything that has a return that doesn't change over its lifetime. You see, when you put in the money, you know, like they're talking, like right now, the CDs are somewhat higher than what they've been. And let's just make one up and say it's 5%. Cool, for a year. And I did look up to yesterday, and I didn't notice that that was the case. There is at least one issuer of 5% CDs for a year. You will get 5% on whatever amount of money for a year's period. But at what you don't know is, what are you going to make in a year and a day? Will it be more or will it be less? That's what they call reinvestment risk. Isn't a reason to do it or not to do it all by itself, but it's something that most folks don't really think about. But if you're counting on that income, and that 5% is, you know, subsidizing your lifestyle, and next time it comes due, it's only 4%, well, something's got to give. And you remember the Series I bonds we talked about, oh gosh, I don't know, just a few months ago? Those are the inflation-fighting bonds issued by the Treasury. I mean, guaranteed, you'll get the money. I mean, never a problem. Well, just a few months ago, the rate was 9.6%. Remember that? People were standing in line, all that kind of stuff. Now, that figure, that interest rate, is expected to drop to 3.8%. What? Well, that's because of the change in the inflation rate. And so, you know, that's close to what CDs, high-yield savings accounts, all that kind of stuff. So you got to be careful. And again, reinvestment risk. I mean, the 9.6 is great while you got it, but once it comes due, what's waiting out there for you? I'm not convinced that a lot of this talk about recession is due to two things. One, it seems to me almost like some people want a recession. They have to have a recession because they said there's going to be a recession. Okay? And that's the attitude. That's the perception. And, you know, perceptions become reality sometimes, don't they? And so when you have this recessionary talk, people just start to accept, oh, yeah, well, that's the way it is, and you got to go with it, and it's just a cycle. Well, no, it's not. As I started to say before the break, the news cycle has swung back to this recessionary talk, even as we discussed inflation's coming down, and unemployment is at a 50-year low. You don't have a recession with unemployment at a 50-year low. I don't care. It can't be done. But if you ask folks, like, just look at your neighbor and say, hey, what have you heard about the economy? They're going to tell you, oh, it's so terrible. Oh, my God. The world is coming to an end. Kill me now. Yeah. Well, that's not true. Now, this is in my opinion, but I think I can demonstrate it from some of the data I'm going to share with you. The economic recovery is strong. Americans remain really pessimistic about the economy. And the other point I was going to make, you know, about the attitude is, though, that most people have never dealt with a bad market today. Most investors today have never dealt with a bad market. We haven't had a bad market since, what, 2000? Okay? Well, you had a little interregnum there in 8 and 9. I got that. But for the most part, the markets were up all that interim period. So, you know, when you get a flat tire and you, A, have never had a flat tire, and B, have never had to change a flat tire, that flat tire can be the biggest thing that ever happened to you. So, in any case, you know, as I say, a lot of folks are deeply pessimistic about the economy. And given the financial media and the talking heads, I can't blame them. I don't listen to those people. Not because it doesn't reinforce my own bias, as I've shared with you, but because they're totally wrong. And they're, again, I don't know what they're selling, but why do they want people to be so negative about things? I don't get it. You know, a large percentage of folks, in my opinion, mistakenly think that we're in a recession, are going to have one this year. Okay, maybe we will. But as the recovery progresses, there's less and less justification now for all these negative hot takes and gloomy economic speculation from the media. The evidence paints a very different picture. You know, the John Candy School of Economics, just the facts, Jack. That's where I like to go. So for March, and here's a big example, a good example of the folks' mentality. For March, money market funds pulled in $363 billion 1 month, the third highest ever in data that research firm Morningstar collects going back all the way to 1993. That was only beaten by the early days of when the bug showed up. So this move, recent move in March, has pushed the total assets for money markets to $5.2 trillion, according to the Investment Company Institute. That's crazy. I mean, You can't live off what a money market fund is going to pay you throughout a 30-year retirement. Shoot, off a 10-year retirement. The math is not there, folks. This is not some sales presentation. This is the John Candy method. You know, and I really caution you against becoming too pessimistic. You know, the odds are we're facing what I think could be a brief and shallow recession. Now, whether that proves to be true or not, I don't know. And it really doesn't matter, because if you're invested properly, what you do is, you know, you secure the portholes, batten down the hatches, and ride the storm out. You don't throw your little teeny-weeny lifeboat off into the waves and cross your fingers. No. You know, the slowdown was caused by the Fed, and they can reverse course. You know, and we've had a ton of new stocks making new 52-week highs. Now, these are not recommendations, okay? I go to jail if I start suggesting that, oh, you got to buy these. But this is the reality. This is historic. These companies hit 52-week highs, the highest in the last year, just this last couple weeks. NVIDIA, AstraZeneca, Salesforce, Lockheed Martin, GE, Chipotle, AutoZone, Motorola, Lennar. I mean, these are not junk jewelry companies. These are not those meme stocks that were around. These are legitimate firms who employ a bunch of folks and provide significant strength throughout our entire economy. So, but what we're missing, and again, here we're back to the attitude thing, is you don't see a big breadth, B-R-E-A-D-T-H, sorry, I can't say that well enough, but breadth expansion in the 52-week highs list. As that expands, that'll, of course, tend to pick up momentum for the rest of the market. A gentleman named Julian Emanuel is Managing Director at Evercore ISI. He had this to say. The bottom line is that the economic forward-looking backdrop continues to soften even as the present remains strong and set against an already defensive positioning. The S&P 500 is trading between 3,800 and 4,200. So if their feeling is that if it gets below, you know, 3,800, then you've got more to the downside. And just to refresh your memory, Friday it closed at 4133. Now, my buddy Sam Stovall, he's chief investment strategist at CFRA Research. Sam says, and I'm quoting, "There's a tug of war between those who are feeling optimistic that the Fed will soon be ending the rate tightening program because of softness that we're seeing in the economy, with those who believe the Fed will be forced to raise rates longer because the economy is not, in a sense, surrendering." No, the economy is not surrendering. Sam, you got it, buddy. Now, here's a survey from CNBC, what they call the All-America Economic Survey. And now this is an attitude check if I ever saw one. A record 69% of the public holds negative views about the economy, both now and in the future. The highest percentage in the survey's 17-year history. Excuse me? Sure, things are goofy. I don't want to get into some rant about the world situation. I'm trying to say just with the facts about the economy and investing. But we've been through weird and strange times before. I promise you that. And we've come through on the other side. But this attitude is just beyond my comprehension. I closed with some, how would I say, comments about the state of what the All-American Economic Survey from CNBC saying had the highest percentage of negative views about the economy, and they surveyed 1,000 people nationwide, with 69% coming up with that view. See, 24% of these folks said it's a good time to invest in stocks. And that's the lowest reading in the 17-year history, too. The prior record was last quarter at 26%. Yeah. Anyway, Markets do remain solvent. The major large U.S. cap large cap indices keep pushing up against new highs. Oh, here's J.P. Morgan has an investor survey. Everybody's got to have a survey. Well, J.P. Morgan says close to 95% of the respondents to their survey agreed stocks would fall in price between now and the end of the year. Another 5% or so believe stock prices stay pretty much where they are now. Pretty much none of them think prices are going up. Now, as I said at the top of the show, we're up right now, year to date, on all three major market indicators. I don't know where we're going to end there, but I'm just saying that's a fact. Many investors were adding to short positions, meaning they would benefit if the stocks dropped, throughout the last half of last year, particularly in the big beat-up growth stocks. But rather than close those positions and take the profits last year, they decided to double up and add to their exposure. Well, that helped kick off the rally we saw this year by getting the tech and communications and other growth stocks moving up as those guys had to close their positions. Oh, Harvard has their survey, Harvard CAPS, capital C-A-P-S, Harris poll, and this came out Friday. Says U.S. economy gets poor marks from most Americans. Well, there's consistency here, if nothing else. 49% of folks expect the economy will be in a recession in the next year. Another 39% say the economy's already there. And just 20% say the economy will avoid a recession. Gee, does it seem like folks are focusing on one thing? Maybe so. But contrary to what many seem to believe, the world doesn't end. And it hasn't ended during any recession, correction, or even depression. It hasn't. You still have needs and goals that have to be dealt with, no matter what screeching is coming over the airwaves from the headlines or from social media. If I had to use one word to describe folks thinking about money in general, it would be anxious. And if you're just finding trouble to feel fine, consider this. There is no data, spreadsheet, article, anything that can guarantee that you'll be fine. Now, I know there's a lot of people who like to talk about retirement projections as if they can guarantee you what the future holds. And there is definitely value in having a strategy, absolutely. But the value is not that it gives you certainty. Just like any strategy, financial ones are, well, guesses about the future, and they can tell you which direction we're headed, but they lack position when it comes to your final destination because things change. Now, the truth, as I've mentioned many times before on the show, is that the certainty of uncertainty equals reality. You can be sure in the marketplace that you cannot be certain about the results. That's reality. And while that's true, it doesn't mean you should live your lives petrified with fear. If you have a good strategy with quality issues and understand what you can and cannot control, cannot being chief among them prices and interest rates, you're going to be a lot better off. Living with uncertainty becomes a whole lot easier once you accept that the magic certainty button does not exist. It's not real, so don't bother looking for it or hoping for it. You know, this idea of an economic recession is so scary and politically radioactive. You know, they call it the R word, right? Well, contracting economic activity, somewhat rising unemployment, and again, you know, that's certainly a relative term, and increasing levels of financial distress are painful for all those that are in it. There's an old wheeze that says a recession is when you're out of work, a depression is when I'm out of work. But as with everything, context matters. With the economy, the levels of the underlying, if you will, big picture parts of the economy, anytime it goes in recession, helps you understand how things may or may not get. Like now, consumer finances are remarkably strong. Torsten Slok, he's a chief economist at Apollo. He's worked at other big firms before. He had this to offer. U.S. households are in excellent shape. The ratio of liabilities to net worth is down 50% since the 08 financial crisis. And household leverage is currently down at levels last seen in the early 80s. If unemployment rate rises, consumer spending may slow down, but the starting point for U.S. households is very strong. J.P. Morgan Asset Management puts out a quarterly report. They call it the Guide to the Markets. And in the second quarter of this year, that particular issue says that according to their estimates, based on the Fed data, debt payments as a percentage of personal income are near historic lows. That's good. That means that should economic conditions deteriorate, consumers have more financial flexibility. And, you know, while it wouldn't be pleasant at all, a major collapse in spending might only get us back to pre-pandemic levels. And I don't think there are any serious economists, emphasis on serious, who see this happening even in their most bearish scenarios. You know, and speaking of unemployment rising, in March, this March, the unemployment rate nationally was 3.5%. That was the rate in 1969, when we had a whole lot fewer people working. The Fed estimates the unemployment rate could rise to 4.5%. You know, the magnitude of such a move over a short period could be recessionary, and certainly that gets the attention of Congress, so and it gets political, and that turns everything silly. But reality is that a 4.5% unemployment rate only gets you back to where we were in October of 21. Okay? So before the bug showed up, during the previous expansion that ran from 2009 to 2020, the unemployment rate did not fall to 4.5% until March of 2017. So put it another way, unemployment rates of 4.5% have been associated with periods of economic expansion. Oh no, CNBC didn't tell me that. The economy is incredibly strong right now. It has lots of underlying fundamental strength, which means the recession we may or may not be heading to may not be that bad. A recession may cause the economy to shrink. You know, think of a double XL shirt. If you have it and you wash it and it shrinks, it's still a shirt. It may be a little tight, but you can still wear it. Okay? There's always the risk that a recession gains momentum and proves difficult to reverse. That's my concern, is that everybody starts believing all this hoo-ha and just say, well, I can't spend money because I'm in a recession. I'm afraid about my job, even though there's no reason to be directly. But it says on the radio that, you know, blah, blah, blah. But what matters most is that we may have a recession doesn't mean we're doomed to experience the same pain of past recessions. I think too many people tie the thought of recession to the 08 period, which was way unfun. And so, but most recessions in my experience, and I've experienced a few in my career, were nothing like that. And, you know, they're uncomfortable, but life goes on. We haven't found anything. Something, anyway, that's breaking the back of the market, and we certainly give it plenty of chances so far. So my advice is stay with quality, have a good strategy, put your fingers in the ears when you're watching the financial news, and just sit back on the couch and eat bonbons and look out the window. That's how you're going to make money when markets are doing this. And so with that in mind, I hope that you have a tremendous week, positive in all regards. I see we had a great ad to the Zags this week. Hooray for us. So have a great week, folks. We'll be back next Saturday with more economic news and market comments. I hope you found this interesting and at least a little educational. My name is Mike Mayle. This is Money Management, powered by the Opus 111 Group.
Join us again next Saturday morning at this same time for the financial insight, opinion, and perspective of Money Management with Opus 111's Mike Mayle. Have a question or comment? Email us at info@opus111group.com or visit our website, opus111group.com. Sections of this radio show contain forward-looking statements that are not guarantees of future performance. This information is from sources we believe to be reliable. However, we cannot guarantee that it is accurate or complete. These comments are for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, nor as a recommendation to buy or sell any security or investment product mentioned in this show. Investing involves risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Individual circumstances do vary. Please consult an investment professional prior to making any investment decisions.